Hello, welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, November 28th. We'll begin today with the mini editorial, and that was written by Greg Nooney of Sioux City. And Greg writes, "We know Republicans are against voter fraud. Now that Kim Taylor has been found guilty of 52 counts of fraud, and her husband Jeremy has been named an unindicted co-conspirator, it's time for him to resign from his position as Woodbury County Supervisor." Again, this was written by Greg Nooney of Sioux City. And we'll now move to the Siouxland's five-day forecast. And today will be mostly sunny and not quite as cold, with a high of 44 and a low tonight of 19. Wednesday will be mostly sunny and milder, with a high of 53 and a low of 24. Thursday will be cooler, breezier in the afternoon, with a high of 41 and a low of 18. Friday will be more sunshine than clouds, with a high of 39 and a low of 23. And Saturday will be mostly cloudy, with a high of 39 and a low of 28. Our first story from the front page is written by Sioux City Journal reporter Earl Horlick, and it's about the NAIA volleyball tourney. When McKenna Clungston left the University of St. Catherine a few days ago, the temperature at the San Marcos, California campus was 75 and sunny. Arriving in Sioux City on Monday afternoon, a gusty northwest breeze kept the temp down to a brisk 29 degrees. Clungston, a St. Catherine psychology senior, said with a sigh, "We're sure not in California anymore." Even with snow on the ground, she was all smiles. After all, Clungston is a member of the St. Catherine Firebirds women's volleyball team. The Firebirds are one of the 24 teams advancing to the National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics, or the NAIA, Women's Volleyball Championship, which has been hosted in Sioux City for the past 16 years. Starting Wednesday and continuing until December 5th, the national championships bring some of the best women collegiate athletes under one roof. Coming from all over the country, the women converge in Sioux City for the bragging rights of becoming the nation's top volleyball team. For Clungston's teammate, Mackenzie Cumby, a setter from Buckeye, Arizona, getting to the championship tournament is a dream come true. "We're seniors this year," Cumby, a psychology major, explained. "This is the first the team has made it to nationals, and it will be the last one where I'm eligible to play. This proves all of our hard work was worth it." Even though this is the Firebirds' first appearance at the volleyball championship, Aaron Leha-Martin is an old pro. Previously the head volleyball coach for Vanguard University of Costa Mesa, California, her team made it to the NAIA championship tournament for 5 years. Alexis Morris, a psychology senior from Menifee, California, credited Leha-Martin for much of the team's success. At 6'4" tall, Morris is also the Firebirds' star blocker. "Unlike McKenna and Mackenzie, this is my first year on the Firebirds team," she said. "We've become so close, they are now my sisters." With semester finals taking place in 3 weeks, the three women are also study partners. "We were studying for finals just this morning," Clungston said. "Even though we're far from home, we still have to study for exams." Although Morris has never been in the Midwest before, she can already appreciate the Sioux City vibe. "It feels different here," she said. "Things move at a slower pace. I like it." Hosting NAIA tournaments often give area businesses a shot in the arm, since athletes, their families, and team personnel will shop at stores or dine out at nearby restaurants. That is, if Cumby can manage the change in the weather. "I'm from Arizona," she said with a smile. "This is too cold for me." The next front page story is a headline, "Tribes, Thurston County Reach Voting Rights Settlement." And this was written by Nick Heitrek from the Sioux City Journal. The Winnebago and Omaha tribes have reached an agreement with Thurston County in which Native Americans would make up a majority of voters in 5 of 7 County Board of Supervisors districts. The plan does not displace any current supervisors from their districts, giving incumbents a chance to run for re-election in their present districts when their current terms are on the ballot in 2024 or 2026. Also of importance, the redrawn districts, the tribes and the county agree, comply with the Voting Rights Act. The tribes had argued in a lawsuit that the current map violated the law and was approved by the board to ensure white politicians maintain control in a county in which natives make up a majority of the voting age population. The agreement awaits a federal judge's signature on a consent decree that would lead to the adoption of the new district plan and the lawsuit's dismissal. Representatives of the tribes and the civil rights groups that represented them could not be reached for comment on Monday. County Board Chairman Glenn Meyer said he did not want to comment on the settlement until everything had been finalized. The tribes and 9 individuals sued Thurston County, the 7 county board members, and the county clerk in January in U.S. District Court in Omaha for the alleged Voting Rights Act violations, saying the current district map approved in 2022 does not provide Native voters a fair chance to elect candidates of their choice in at least 4 of the districts. Natives make up 50.3% of the voting age population, compared with 43% of whites in Thurston County, which is home to both the Winnebago and the Omaha Indian reservations. Other races make up the remainder of the county's population. Because of their majority, the tribe said in the lawsuit, natives should have a legitimate chance to elect representatives in at least 4 districts, but the current plan gives them a clear majority in only 3. Though natives have a slight majority in 2 other districts, the lawsuit said, those districts were drawn purposely by non-native board members to take advantage of traditional low native voter turnout, making them safe for white incumbents. The current board currently has 2 members who are native and 5 who are white. The county denied the discrimination claims and argued that the redrawn districts, which were drawn by an independent vendor, met Voting Rights Act requirements. The new districts were used in the 2022 election cycle, in which no Native candidates ran in 3 of the 4 districts up for election. Under the agreed-upon redistricting, Natives would have a majority of voters in 5 districts. Natives would have majorities of 95% and 87% in districts that include Macy and Winnebago, respectively. Native majorities in the other 3 districts would be 74%, 69%, and 53%. In the remaining 2 districts, white voters would have majorities of 94% and 85%. Under terms of the agreement, the county does not admit the current map violates state or federal law, but acknowledges a judge could order the county to redraw the map when considering the evidence. Once a judge issues a consent decree to approve the new districts, the county will have 30 days to adopt the plan. The new districts would be in place for the 2024 election, when 3 board seats are up for election. The plan will remain in effect until at least after the 2030 census, when population shifts could cause the districts to be redrawn. The current voting rights lawsuit is the 3rd the tribes have filed against Thurston County. In 1978, the Justice Department sued the county over its at-large method of electing supervisors. A consent decree in that case resulted in the current 7-district format. A 2nd lawsuit stemmed from redistricting after the 1990 census that diluted Native voting strength by not creating a 3rd district in which Natives had an effective majority. Our next headline is City Likely to Continue Negotiating with the Exes, and this is written by Dolly Butts. Sioux City. The Sioux City City Council moved forward a resolution for the Sioux City Explorers lease of Lewis and Clark Park Monday. However, negotiations with the ball club will likely continue before the lease is finalized. Mayor Bob Scott said, "I think 12 years is too long. I'm going to move that we do a 9-year lease. You could go 2, almost 3 councils before people would get to vote on it." He said that before the council, by voting in favor of its consent agenda, approved a resolution inviting proposals for the lease of land in the Donner Park urban renewal area and announcing the city's intent to accept the Explorers' proposal. Since the stadium is located in an urban renewal area, the city must follow the urban renewal law and give a 30-day notice of its intent to lease the park to the Explorers. A public hearing on the matter will be scheduled for January 8th. The Explorers want a 12-year agreement and to pay the city $100,000 per year by May 1st to lease the ballpark. which includes office spaces, locker rooms, stadium grounds, field equipment, playing and practice fields, spectator areas, as well as use of the paved parking lot around the stadium. Parks and Recreation Director Matt Salvatore said city staff doesn't have a problem with a 12-year lease. He said, "This is just inviting proposals, so we're at a point where we can still make changes prior to approving the final lease. That feedback and any other feedback is welcome at this time. We can make changes." With the excess current 10-year lease set to expire in April, the Sioux City Parks and Recreation Department put out a request for proposals, or RFP, for the city-owned stadium at 3400 Line Drive. In addition to the Explorers, who have played at the stadium since it opened in 1993, the Northwoods Leagues, a college wooden bat summer league, submitted a proposal to lease the park. Scott has said, "We put a lot of money in the park the last couple of years, a lot of money. There was nothing that was said that about we have to put so much back in the park. But now that's part of this. $50,000 a year has to go back in the park. That wasn't part of your original request for the proposals. So we don't know that the other group didn't have a better deal, quite frankly. That's what's a little bit alarming to me." Tom Backemeyer, Vice President and General Manager of the Explorers, told the council that a 12-year lease provides long-term stability and coincides with the ball club's affiliation agreement with the American Association of Professional Baseball. He said, "I will say that our league will not consider a short-term lease. Traditionally, any ballpark lease that our league would consider would be a 10 years or above," he said. "That's not a written rule within our league. Our league requests that we secure long-term agreements. They would prefer an agreement of at least 10 years, but I don't have anything in writing saying that it has to be that." Councilman Alex Waters said he wants the ball club to update the council twice a year, once at midseason and once at the end of the season. "I thought that would be really helpful to get to some of the things I was talking about before entering negotiations, such as where we are in attendance, where we are with public participation, or just community involvement. I think that's what I said, and then just looking at capital projects." A selection committee comprised of Nick Palamiotti, OVG's 360's general manager of the Orpheum Theater and the Tyson Events Center, Joe Craig, a member of the Parks and Recreation Advisory Board, Dustin Cooper of the Sioux City Sports Commission, Ward Franz, Director of Sports Tourism for Explore Sioux City, and Teresa Fitch, Sioux City Finance Director, met on September 15th and formally recommended the Explorers' proposal be presented to the Parks and Recreation Advisory Board for consideration and approval. On September 27th, the Parks and Recreation Advisory Board unanimously voted in favor of the Selection Committee's recommendation. The day after the advisory board's vote, Craig told the Journal, "The monetary difference between the proposals was pretty big, which made the decision easier." But he noted that everything looked great concerning the Northwoods League and the Explorers having a proven track record. Then in October, the council voted to authorize city staff to enter into negotiations with the Explorers to formulate a lease agreement. Under the proposed agreement, the X's would be responsible for maintaining and making repairs to the premises and fixed assets up to $1,000 per occurrence, according to the proposed lease agreement. The city would continue to be responsible for capital improvement projects and furnish air conditioning and heating equipment, which the Explorers are responsible for maintaining. The ball club would provide the city 400 complimentary single game tickets annually for each year of the lease, as well as 400 complimentary tickets for two dates during each year of the lease to the current and any future field naming sponsor. If the city would allow another group to use a facility on available calendar days, the proposed agreement states that the group using the facility would pay for event-related expenses and a reasonable facility rental amount mutually agreed upon by landlord and tenant. The city may reserve 15 calendar days for non-tenant events, according to the proposed agreement. The 15 days of landlord use for non-tenant activities may include high school and college usage for baseball and non-baseball events. The move to open up the stadium lease came after the city and the Explorers fought for months over the condition of the stadium seating. At one point, team owner John Roost, a local businessman, threatened to move the team elsewhere unless the city replaced all of the seats, which he described as being in serious and poor condition. In June, the City Council approved a $429,000 contract with the Sioux Falls Gym Equipment and Bleacher Dealer for 2,300 upper-level seats. Replacement of the upper-level seats is expected to be completed by May 1, 2024. The city previously replaced 770 seats in the stadium's lower bowl in time for the Explorers' first weekend series of the 2023 season. We'll now move to a regular column for the journal. It's called Five Questions With, and today's is written by Mason Doctor, and the subject is Sioux City native ACLU executive Libby Skarin. And the Mason Doctor is the reporter. This has been a red letter autumn for Libby Skarin. In September, the Sioux City born and raised attorney, a 2004 graduate of East High School, was named Deputy Executive Director of the ACLU of South Dakota, North Dakota, and Wyoming. A little more than a month later, on November 6, she was named the Acting Executive Director. Skarin, 37, joined the ACLU's office in Sioux Falls in 2014 as Policy Director for the group's South Dakota operations. In 2020, she became the Campaigns Director, overseeing the organization's advocacy staff and programming in the ACLU's three-state region. A graduate of the University of Iowa, Skarin began her career in Sioux City. While still a law student, she worked with the Sioux City Human Rights Commission in the summer of 2009. After graduating from law school, she moved back to Sioux City and worked as an assistant attorney general in the Child Support Recovery Unit in 2012 and 2013. The journal spoke with Skarin about this new turn in her career. Questions and answers have been edited for style and clarity. So, question one. What are some of the top issues the ACLU of South Dakota, North Dakota, and Wyoming is trying to address? And the answer. Our mission at the ACLU of North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming is to protect and defend and advance civil rights and civil liberties that are guaranteed to everyone in our states under both state and federal constitutions. We take what I would describe as a three-pronged approach to our work, and those three prongs would be legal work, advocacy work, and then communications. So we use those three different types of work and different tactics to achieve the civil rights and the civil liberties that we are all guaranteed. Sometimes we are defending them, sometimes we're trying to advance them or expand them, but fundamentally that is the work that we do. In terms of our priority issues, they change a little bit from state to state. But looking at the region as a whole, I would say our priorities are working on fighting against attacks on abortion access and fighting against the criminalization of abortion. We do a lot of work on transgender rights. Indigenous justice is a big part of our work in this region of the country. Immigrant rights, criminal justice reform, and then I think one of the things that the ACLU is perhaps most known for is our First Amendment work. And I think we really in a interesting era where we're seeing more and more threats to the First Amendment, and we're finding ourselves working on these issues that have been long established rights, especially when we look at things like book bans or censorship in classrooms and things of that nature. And then the next question. From your perspective, are civil liberties in South Dakota, North Dakota, and Wyoming in a good place, or are they under threat? And she answers, the nature of civil rights and civil liberties is that they are always under threat. Like, once you've got a right established, you truly have to approach it with a vigilance and approach it, keeping in mind that rights that have been gained could be lost. And that is a thing that I think a lot of people maybe don't recognize or assume doesn't happen. But we are living in an era where we are absolutely seeing the rights that have long been established under attack. And in some cases, like with abortion and the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision, we're seeing rights being rolled back. So I would say, in general, civil rights and civil liberties are always a thing that requires vigilance and protection. I would say that when we're talking about civil rights and civil liberties in this region, I mean they certainly are under threat. And I think part of the reason that our priority issues are what they are is in response to what we are seeing happening in our three states. I think you'll find that from state to state and from government to government, the sort of things we're seeing legislated do differ somewhat. But here in this region, it feels to me like we are working on things that feel very foundational and fundamental. For example, some of this First Amendment work that we do. I truly would not have thought, if you had told me in 2014 when I started this job, that we would be fighting book bans. I might not have believed you, because it's such a clear violation of the First Amendment to ban books. To me, it seemed, this is so well established that certainly we couldn't see this right being eroded. And now we're watching it happen in real time. And I think that really just speaks to the nature of civil rights and the fact that once rights are established, we have to fight to maintain them and to ensure that they remain in place for future generations and for people today. Then the next question. Does the legal, political, or social climate in South Dakota, North Dakota, and Wyoming make for a different calculus or a more challenging environment for the ACLU than in other states? And she answers, I think so. The political environment and the legal environment informs how we do our work and the ways we're able to get things done. And I would say that a lot of people think that it must be so hard doing this work in North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming. And there are elements of it, of course, that are very difficult. But I think the thing that probably makes it most challenging, especially when we're talking about advocacy work and lobbying and state legislatures, is not necessarily the underlying politics, but rather the fact that we've got these supermajorities in all of our state houses. When you have a supermajority, I think regardless of which party is in power, you truly see so many barriers to getting things done. And I think that in general, you see less good policy coming out, because there is this stifling of dissent and true debate and a really coming together when you've got one party that essentially rules, both a supermajority of the legislature, but also sort of the executive branch. So yes, it is challenging. I think there are a lot of assumptions about the type of person, maybe quote unquote, who supports the ACLU. It happens to me fairly often when I'll encounter someone and they'll ask where I work and they'll say, oh, well, the ACLU. I like some of what you guys do, but don't tell anyone. And it's this kind of joke of like some people might not want to say publicly that they support the ACLU, but given the nature of our work and just the sheer amount and number of issues we take on, I think you'd be hard pressed to find someone who doesn't agree with our position on at least a couple of things. And I think that part of being successful in our mission is that we have to be able to build bridges with people, and we have to be able to find common ground where it exists. And then our fourth question, what drew you to the career path you have chosen? And she answers, I went into college thinking I wanted to be a writer, that I wanted to be a journalist. I remember, I don't know how old I would have been or if it was some sort of like career day thing, but I remember I spent a Saturday at the Sioux City Journal office pretending to be a journalist. They had kids set up at computers and stuff, and it was a long time ago, but back then I thought that's what I would do when I grew up. But in college, I was a political science major and a journalism major, and I really loved my classes on constitutional law in particular. And so that kind of pushed me in the direction of thinking about law school and exploring what law school might be like. And of course, when you're in journalism school, you've got your legal and ethics classes. And if you're going to do media work, you're going to do work with the press, you have heard of the ACLU, because the ACLU has once some of the most seminal First Amendment cases out there. Some of those, of course, on press freedom, but in general on freedom of speech. So I would say between those classes and constitutional law, I became very enamored with the idea of doing that sort of work, and especially drawn to civil rights. And that only strengthened throughout my time in law school. And I knew, like at that point, I would have told you my dream job was working at the ACLU, but I didn't necessarily think that would happen because I thought to work with the ACLU, you probably have to live in New York or some big city, which is not what I wanted. And then our final question, did your early experiences in Sioux City shape your worldview? Yes, I mean, of course, I think it's inevitable that the way you grew up and the time and the place that you grew up in shapes your worldview. Born and raised in Sioux City, my parents still live in the same house that they lived in when they brought me home from the hospital. And so I do think my worldview has been shaped by experiences I had growing up in Sioux City. And even now, I think it's interesting, and I thought it was very interesting when I first moved to Sioux Falls, sort of getting this comparison between Sioux Falls versus Sioux City. And the things you learn about Iowa history, or like Sioux City history, for whatever reason, those fourth grade lessons really stuck in my brain. And I think it's just interesting to sort of compare the two and think about all the context, and especially the more I've learned about the indigenous people of this region. And we did learn a decent amount of that in school when I was a kid in Sioux City. But seeing that in a different perspective by moving to Sioux Falls and moving to South Dakota, which is a state with a very large, comparatively, population of indigenous people, I think having that sort of basis for comparison has helped sort of shape my worldview even today. And again, this was five questions with Libby Scarron, who is the currently the an executive with the ACLU of South Dakota, North Dakota, and Wyoming. And our next story, man dies after crashing stolen car in Sioux City. A 24-year-old Sioux City man is dead after leading police on a pursuit and crashing a stolen vehicle on the city's north side. Sioux City police identified the man as Gunnar Lee Kratz in a statement. After the crash, Kratz was taken to a local hospital with life-threatening injuries. He was later pronounced dead at the hospital, according to the statement. At 7:51 p.m. Sunday, officers attempted to stop a 2014 Dodge Charger that had been reported stolen earlier that day. Kratz refused to stop for police and continued to elude officers through the city's west side and north side, according to the statement. He lost control of the vehicle and crashed in the 1700 block of Floyd Boulevard. Sioux City Police Sergeant Tom Gill said the vehicle Kratz was driving reached speeds in excess of 80 miles per hour during the pursuit. Kratz also led Sioux City Police on a high-speed chase in a stolen vehicle in 2018, according to court documents. On March 16th of that year, law enforcement attempted to stop Kratz for driving 60 miles per hour in a 50-mile-per-hour zone in the southbound lanes of Interstate 29. Kratz accelerated to more than 100 miles per hour, and police found that the gray 2006 Chevrolet Monte Carlo he was driving had been reported stolen from South Sioux City about 5 hours previous. Police pursued Kratz into South Sioux City and then back into Sioux City on numerous Sioux City streets and highways, according to documents. The vehicle drove more than 40 miles per hour over the speed limit and ran numerous stoplights and stop signs. Kratz admitted to using meth approximately an hour before that pursuit. Kratz pleaded guilty in a plea agreement to felony eluding and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Charges of operating while intoxicated, first offense and second degree theft were dismissed. Search for missing Wall Lake trucker ongoing. There was nothing new to report Monday in the search for missing Wall Lake, Iowa truck driver David Schultz, the Sac County Sheriff's Office said in an update on Monday. Over the weekend, volunteers searched for Schultz in Wright, Webster, Calhoun, and Sac County, according to the sheriff's office. Nothing was found. The search continued on Monday. Schultz, a 53-year-old married father of 10-year-old twin boys, vanished last week. He was last heard from in the early morning hours last Tuesday, according to the Lakeview Police Department. His truck was found Tuesday afternoon northeast of Sac City, parked on northbound U.S. Highway 71, about 5 miles north of the old U.S. Highway 20 intersection. The truck was reportedly turned off, but it wasn't pulled over, and the trailer was still loaded with young pigs. The Iowa Division of Criminal Investigations is assisting the Sac County Sheriff's Office and the Lakeview Police Department in this investigation. The United Cajun Navy, a nonprofit organization that organizes search and rescue teams, has been involved in the searches. Northeast Sac County property owners have been asked to check their property and outbuildings for anything out of the ordinary. The Lakeview Police Department has asked anyone who has seen or heard from Schultz to contact them at 712-657-2513. The Sac County Communications Center can be reached at 712-662-7127. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, November 28th on Iris. We'll now turn to today's obituaries. Beverly J. Nelson, 91, of Cherokee, Iowa, went home to be with the Lord on Wednesday morning, November 22nd, at Lawton Senior Living in Lawton. Memorial services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, December 2nd, at the Cleghorn Presbyterian Church in Cleghorn, Iowa. Pastor Larry Osterkamp will officiate. Visitation will be held an hour prior to the service at the church in Cleghorn. Private family burial will be held. The Boothie Funeral Home in Cherokee is assisting the family with arrangements. Beverly was born on June 11, 1932, in rural Cherokee County, Iowa, the daughter of Claire and Helen Mole Green. She graduated from Cleghorn Community School in 1949 and received her teaching certificate from Buena Vista College in 1950. She went on to teach a total of 28 years in the Cleghorn, Meridian Cleghorn, and the Marcus Meridian Cleghorn Community School systems. She taught middle school, kindergarten, and transitional kindergarten during those years. Bev married Roy L. Nelson on July 14, 1951 in Cherokee. They made their home in Marcus, Cleghorn, and then on the Nelson family farm near Cleghorn. They built a new home in Cleghorn in the early 1980s and lived there until they moved to Cherokee. They had been married nearly 39 years when Roy suddenly passed away on March 19, 1990. Bev had continued to live in the Cherokee area since that time. In July 2021, she moved to the Gardens Assisted Living Facility. In April 2023, she moved to Lawton Senior Living. Bev enjoyed being a homemaker, family farm helper, and doing substitute teaching while raising the couple's three children, Diane, Rick, and Nancy. Bev was a longtime member of the Cleghorn Presbyterian Church and taught Sunday school and held many offices during her membership there. She was always active in the women's circle and helped in any function that she needed that needed a capable pair of hands. Bev also enjoyed her bridge groups, walking and exercising at the Wellness Center in Cherokee, going to movies, reading, doing crossword puzzles, spending time with family friends, traveling, and faithfully attending her grandchildren's school activities. Rita R. Beerworth, 84, of Lamar's, passed away on Sunday, November 26, at her home, surrounded by her family. Funeral services will take place at 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, November 30th, at Grace Lutheran Church in Lamar's. Reverend Timothy Gates will officiate. Burial will follow at Memorial Cemetery in Lamar's. Visitation will begin at 2 p.m. on Wednesday, November 29th at the Maurer Johnson Funeral Home in Lamar's. The family will be present from 5 to 7 with a prayer service scheduled at 7 p.m. There will also be 1 hour of visitation at the church prior to the funeral service on Thursday. Rosemary E. Fessler, 92, Larrabee, Iowa, passed away Thursday, November 23rd in Cherokee. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. November 29th at Boothie Funeral Home in Cherokee. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service. Burial will be at the Cedar Cemetery. Vera Didecker, 103, of Laurel, Nebraska, died November 22nd. Funeral will be 10:30 a.m. on November 30th at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Laurel. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday at the church. Arrangements are with the Winst Funeral Home in Laurel. Darlene Marie Freilich Miller, 87, of Sioux City, passed away on Wednesday, November 22nd at Lawton Senior Living. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, November 29th at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel, 6200 Morningside Avenue in Sioux City. The family will greet friends 1 hour prior to the service. Burial will be at the Memorial Park Cemetery. Darlene, the daughter of Alva Albert and Marjorie Elaine McIntosh Freilich, was born June 22, 1936, in Cherokee, Iowa. She grew up in Cleghorn, Iowa, where she graduated from high school before attending Morningside College in Sioux City. While at Morningside College, Darlene met her future husband, Robert Bob Miller, and they were later united in marriage on July 6, 1956. This union was blessed with three children, Pamela, Susan, and Scott. Early in their marriage, Darlene and Bob lived in Huntsville, Alabama, while he served in the military, and later returned to make their home in Sioux City. For over 40 years, Darlene worked as a sales clerk in the handbag department at Yonkers Department Store. Bob passed away on January 27, 2010. Darlene enjoyed reading, shopping, playing cards, flower gardening, and golfing, even recording a hole-in-one at the Sioux City Boat Club. Additionally, she had a love for handbags and jewelry, enjoyed going out to eat at different restaurants, and loved following Morningside University athletics. She was a member of Grace United Methodist Church. A special thank you to the staff at both Lawton Senior Living and St. Croix Hospice for their compassionate service and care provided to Darlene these past few years. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Morningside University Athletics, where Darlene was in her happy place watching many events. Helena J. Lawrence, 95, of Sioux City, passed away on Saturday, November 18th at a local care facility. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday, December 1st at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service. Interment will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Helena Marie Lawrence was born on December 25, 1927 in Okotin, South Dakota, one of 13 children born to George and Marie Joffer. She received her education in South Dakota and Minnesota, graduating in 1944 in Chandler, Minnesota. She went on to attend Hope College in Holland, Michigan, where she received a teaching degree. She joined Alpha Theta Kappa sorority, where she retained membership for over 50 years. She taught for 5 years in country schools in South Dakota, for a year and a half in Holland, Michigan, and for 6 years in Denver prior to joining the Sioux City Community School District. There she taught for 27 years, including years at Grant from 1963 to 1979 and at Hunt from 1979 to 1990. On June 22, 1974, Helena married Harold Lawrence at First Presbyterian Church in Sioux City. Helena and Harold enjoyed traveling together and attending his military ship's reunions. She also enjoyed crossword puzzles, playing games with her nieces and nephews, growing violets, and volunteering at schools. Philip D. Wash, age 91, of Alta, Iowa, died Saturday, November 25th, at Methodist Manor Retirement Community in Storm Lake. Funeral services will take place at 11 a.m. Saturday, December 2nd, at St. Mark Lutheran Church in Storm Lake. Burial will be in the Scandinavian Cemetery in Alta. Visitation will take place 1 hour prior to the service at the church. The Francie and Jensen Funeral Home in Alta is in charge of the arrangements. Diane Gibson, 80, of Sergeant Bluff, passed away at her home, surrounded by her family. Services will be held at 6 p.m. November 30th at the Waterbury Funeral Service in Sioux City at 4125 Orleans Avenue. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. at the funeral home. Carol Anna Marmo, 99, of South Sioux City, passed away peacefully with her children by her side on November 25th of natural causes. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Friday, December 1st at the Moore and Becker Hunt Funeral Home in South Sioux City with Reverend Ronald Benson of Crete, Nebraska officiating. Burial will follow at the Dakota City Cemetery. Visitation with the family present will be 1 hour prior to services. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to the charitable choice of the family. Carol was born on January 6, 1924 to Irvin and Marie Lischke Tebbin in South Sioux City. After Carol graduated from South Sioux City High School in 1942, she went on to study and graduated from the National Business College in Sioux City. She married childhood sweetheart Louis Joseph Marmo in Phoenix, Arizona on September 11, 1943, after various jobs and traveling through the western part of the United States while he was in the Army. They settled on a farm west of South Sioux City, where they raised their family of 6 children, Linda, Christine, Jill, Brent, Roxy, and Denise. Over the years, besides being a full-time mother, she worked various bookkeeping jobs and was involved in the local Credit Women's Association. Kathy Ann Downey, 72, of rural Lawton, passed away peacefully on Friday, November 24th at a local hospital after a weeks-long journey with family and friends by her side. Abiding by family wishes, cremation has taken place and a celebration of life service will be held in the spring for her family and friends. Moore and Becker Hunt Funeral Home is assisting the family. Memorials can be sent to the Siouxland Humane Society or the Sioux City Public Library in Kathy's name. Kathy was born on November 17, 1951 in Sioux City to Francis, Woody, and Shirley Woodford, the oldest of seven children. She grew up in rural Ponca, Nebraska, enjoyed riding horses, fishing, being outdoors, and adventuring through the Ponca State Park. Kathy received her education in Ponca, Nebraska, where she was a member of the Pep Club, Softball, Luther League, and the school choir before graduating with the class of 1970. During high school, she received her CNA, Certified Nurse's Assistant Certificate, and worked at the St. Joseph's Hospital in Sioux City. Kathy married Raleigh R. Downey on October 20, 1973 at Salem Lutheran Church in Ponca, and the couple made Anthon, Iowa their home. She continued to work at St. Joseph Hospital as a nursing assistant before becoming a physical therapist assistant during the hospital's name change to Mercy Hospital. She retired after 40 years of service and was a very caring and giving person. Kathy kept busy with the Corvette Club, car shows, Red Hat Society, and the Christmas shoe party, and trips to Missouri with the gang. She volunteered at the Sioux City Food Bank and the Humane Society after her retirement, and she enjoyed gardening, reading. She loved the Sioux City Library, hosting parties at her acreage, and loved Halloween and beer flag. Kathy became a cat enthusiast and loved animals in general. She rescued many, many animals in her lifetime. She loved spending time with the family playing 10-point pitch and various card games and scolding those who cheated. She was a Husker and Iowa football fan and enjoyed every second she could with neighbors and friends, and Kathy loved her many nieces and nephews. One of Kathy's happiest moments was helping plan and organize the Woodford family reunion in 2022. Tina Marie Mercado Sargent, 44, of Sioux City, passed away November 23rd at a local hospital. A celebration of life will be held from 11 to 1 p.m. Friday, December 1st, at Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Charles Floyd Chuck Widman, 72, passed away unexpectedly from natural causes on a farm in rural Bronson, Friday, November 24th. A Mass of Christian Burial will be held at 10 a.m. Wednesday, November 29th at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church with Father Brad Pelzel celebrating. Visitation with the family will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, November 28th with a vigil service at 7 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Burial will be at West Fork Township Cemetery, Climbing Hill Cemetery. Chuck was born July 10, 1951, to William Ernest Widman and Alice June Widman. He was the fifth of eight children and was raised on a farm in rural Bronson. He grew up learning how to be a bottom farmer in the Missouri River Gumbo. For those who have farmed in the area, they understand knowing how to farm that ground is an art. He attended Bronson Community School and graduated from Lawton Bronson Community School in 1969. He met the love of his life, Charlene Marie Schreuer, at the Woodbury County Fair Dance in the summer of 1968. He always said it was love at first sight. They were married at Immaculate Conception Church in Mobile on August 19, 1972, and started their life on a farm in rural Bronson, where they have lived their entire married life. Chuck and Charlene were blessed with two daughters, Courtney Brooke and Kimberly Dawn. They grew up learning the value of hard work, the joy of family time, and most importantly, faith in God. Chuck's kids and grandkids were his pride and joy. He loved traveling, going to the movies, musicals, sitting by the pool, talking, attending his grandkids' events, and eating good food with friends and family. He was the master of power naps and could fall asleep anywhere. We have always believed that skill made him the perfect farmer. Following high school, Chuck attended the University of South Dakota and finished his education at Morningside College, majoring in economics with a minor in political science. His education would help him throughout his career as a farmer. The 1980s farm crisis almost ended his farming career, but through hard work and determination, he was able to continue his family tradition of farming. Chuck enjoyed serving his community through his work on various board of directors. He recently retired from the Woodbury County Rural Electric Cooperative this summer following 39 years of service. He was currently serving on the Ditch District Board. In prior years, he has also served Western Iowa Cooperative, Western Iowa Telephone, and the Northwest Iowa Power Cooperative. He was a member of the Father O'Reilly Knights of Columbus 8232 in Mobile, Iowa. His work ethic, kindness, generosity, faith, and family values will live on through his wife, Charlene, daughters Courtney and Kimberly. He often reminded us that the true miracle in life is the gift of growing old. And that completes the obituaries for today. Our next story is headlined, Iowa's Bird Flu Death Toll This Fall Has Surpassed Last Year. Another massive flock of egg-laying hens in Iowa was recently found to be infected by a very transmissible and deadly version of avian flu, which has pushed the total number of affected birds this fall beyond last year's casualties for the same time period. The recent detection of avian influenza was in a flock of about 1.6 million birds in Sioux County, according to the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Humans are seldom infected by the virus, but it can spread quickly in domestic flocks and is lethal to the birds. Entire flocks are culled to prevent the virus from spreading. That incident more than doubled the total affected Iowa birds since mid-October. Infected sites now total 15, ranging from backyard flocks to immense commercial chicken operations, with nearly 3 million birds. That is more than double the number of detections in October, November, and December of last year, which affected about 2.5 million birds. The final virus confirmation last year happened December 12th. The death toll is largely driven by the type of facility that is infected. Iowa is the nation's leading egg producer, and those chicken flocks can number in the millions. Commercial turkey flocks often have tens of thousands of birds. The smallest flock affected this fall, a backyard group of different species, had 23. The virus is often transmitted to domestic flocks by wild migrating birds that can be asymptomatic. While the infections in Iowa this fall have been worse than last year, the state largely escaped infections during the spring migration, which was devastating last year. The total number of affected birds in 2022 in Iowa was about 16 million. That led to the state's lowest annual egg production in more than a decade, according to the United States Department of Agriculture data. Iowa produced about 12.2 billion eggs in 2022. That was down from 15 billion the year before and from a high of 17 billion in 2019. Iowa's second lowest production total in recent years was in 2015, when there was also a widespread avian flu outbreak. That year, the state produced 12.7 billion eggs. This year, production has rebounded but will be short of 2021 before the latest outbreaks. Through October, Iowa has produced about 11.4 billion eggs this year and has averaged more than a billion each month, according to USDA data. Christmas tree cutting permits available at Nebraska forests. Christmas tree cutting permits in the Nebraska National Forests and Grasslands are now available for the public. The permits will be on sale through December 31st. Any tree under 20 foot tall is available for harvest. Amanda Medeiros, an administrative support assistant at the Bessie Ranger District Office, said any conifer is available for cutting. Last year, she got a Charlie Brown Christmas tree. She said it was a little eastern red cedar. She calls them the classic Christmas tree because the look of it is what people really like. Most people go with the classic cedars. Other conifers that grow through the Samuel R. McKelvey National Forest are ponderosa, Scots pine, and jack pine. Permits are available online at recreation.gov for $10 plus a $2.50 processing fee, or $10 at the Halsey or Chadron Forest Service offices during normal operating hours. Only areas designated on the permit map are open to Christmas tree cutting. Wilderness areas, campgrounds, administrative sites, national recreation areas, research natural area, Pine Ridge Job Corps are excluded areas. Areas affected by the Bovee fire are also off limits. Maps are available at fs.usda.gov/Nebraska. Fourth graders that have an Every Kid Outdoor Pass are eligible for a free Christmas tree permit. A voucher is available at everykidoutdoors.gov/how.htm. Woodbury County LEC meetings videos to be available online. The Woodbury County Law Enforcement Center Authority will provide recordings of their meetings on the county website. The authority is unable to live stream the meetings like the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors, but they will be able to put video recordings up afterward, according to the Board of Supervisors. The recordings will be available on the same page as the meeting and minutes of the LAC Authority and on YouTube. No indication was given as to how long it will take the recordings to be available after the meetings. The idea was proposed last month during the Board of Supervisors' discussions on the jail project and its delay. Supervisors Matthew Ung and Jeremy Taylor proposed the idea. It is unknown when the board will begin recording the videos and posting them. But when they do, the videos will be available at youtube.com/@WoodburyLACAuthority. Festival of Trees prepares for Thursday live auction. The votes are in and the critics have made their choices for Sioux City's 30th Annual Festival of Trees. KCAU-TV's Tim Seaman, iHeartMedia's Rob Powers, and the Journal's Bruce Miller selected the tree decorated by Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church's Lady Society as the most patriotic, while the tree designed by LifeServe Blood Center has the best snowman theme. Holy Spirit Retirement Home's tree was selected best non-traditional item. Ho-Chunk Capital's tree was most beautiful. Winnevegas Casino and Resort's tree was named best setting. And the Maskawaski family's tree picked up most humorous honors. Silent bids on all items will conclude Wednesday night, and the viewing will continue on Thursday at the Ho-Chunk Center at 600 4th Street. The live auction will take place at 6:30 p.m. Thursday in the Ho-Chunk Center's atrium. This year's proceeds from the Festival of Trees will go to support Siouxland Soldiers, a nonprofit organization founded by military families that has shipped more than 6,000 care packages, hosted more than 200 support events, and distributed more than 400,000 pounds of groceries to area enlisted members and veterans since 2007. The Festival of Trees has donated to nearly 30 different nonprofits over the year. Festival of Trees organizer Tom Molstead said, "We are happy to make this merrier Christmas this year for support Siouxland Soldiers." We'll now move to Dear Abby and the first letter. This is in response to Love My Cheap Phone from August 28th. As a millennial who has worked in retail my whole adult life, I'm tired of the excuse that the older generation can't or won't use smartphones. Personal computers have been out for decades, and smartphones have been around more than 16 years. Like the automatic transmission, these things are designed to make our lives easier and should be embraced rather than shunned. I've had people cuss me out over not being able to access discounts due to not having a smartphone, going so far as to claim discrimination. The only person holding them back is themselves, and most of the time smartphones are more intuitive than previously thought. They also all don't cost $1,000. Many basic use smartphones can be bought for under $200, not to mention certain phone companies offer big discounts on people's first smartphone with a new account. I don't feel bad for Love. I suggest they get with the times because these devices are not going away. Signed, Millennial in Oregon. And Abby responds, "Thanks for writing. After that letter appeared, I was inundated with comments from readers. Some of them agreed with you. Other readers understood Love's point and offered suggestions for transitioning more easily to a modern communication device." And apparently the rest of these letters are all going to be about that same topic. So the next one. "I am a senior with mobility issues, and I could not live without my smartphone. It is not a toy. I use it to fill my prescriptions, schedule medical appointments, check test results, and communicate with my doctors. I do most of my shopping, conduct all of my banking online, call up ride sharing, make travel arrangements, and keep in touch with family and friends. I encourage Love to open their mind a bit." This one was signed, Online Senior in California. And then the next one. "There is a government program, Lifeline, that provides a free smartphone and phone service to low-income people. If someone chooses not to have a smartphone for other reasons, that's their choice. But no one should go without one because they cannot afford it." This is signed, Mary in Massachusetts. And then the next one. Some states offer Affordable Connectivity Program, or ACP, which provides free phone service with smartphones and tablets to low-income individuals or those receiving Social Security. A tablet might be the better option to use for the kind of interactions the writer described. And this was signed, hopefully helping out West. And then the next one. I'm guessing Love has family and friends who have older phones in the junk drawers of their homes. Perhaps someone would be willing to part with one. Also, AARP offers classes to learn how to use a smartphone, which I suspect is behind your writer's reluctance to modernize. Signed, Kristen in New Hampshire. And then the last one. As a retired librarian who has helped many seniors with their technology, the idea of a $1,000 smartphone is akin to thinking that all cars are Rolls Royces. Many phones can be had for under $200 and some for less than $100. A number of cell phone and service providers cater to seniors trying to transition from their beloved flip phones. I urge Love to visit their local library and see what advice they can get there. Signed, Mr. G in Syracuse, New York. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, November 8th. I'm Dagna, your reader. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.